Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, driving north from Asheville, North Carolina, toward Johnson City, Tennessee, you pass through a tall and, for the eastern U.S., really majestic mountain range, part of the Blue Ridge Mountains, in the southern Appalachians. At the highest point, the crest, it's around 3,800 feet. And soon after you cross the state line and start down, on your left, to the west, you can see a large, undeveloped, and apparently undisturbed stretch of mountains and forests. This area is called Rocky Fork, and on a snowy day in October 2012, a large section of it was dedicated as the Rocky Fork State Park, the 55th state park to be established in Tennessee, to be exact. It opened to the public in May 2015. My guest is David Ramsey. He was one of the key people in what can only be called the rescuing of this large tract of wild lands from development, and probably was the one who actually spearheaded it. He's a multi-generation native of this area, a professional landscape photographer who's written and recently published a book called Rocky Fork, Hidden Jewel of the Blue Ridge Wild, which is about Rocky Fork and the long effort to preserve it. It's really well written and it's heavily illustrated with beautiful photographs of the area by David and a colleague named Jerry Greer. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Court. Good to be here.
I appreciate you being on. Let's start with a quick physical description of Rocky Fork. How big is it and what does it consist of?
Well, Rocky Fork is 10,000 acres, if you're talking about the entire watershed. It lies in partly in Unicoi County and partly in Greene County in northeast Tennessee.
There's a lot more to it, right? I mean, in reading your book, it's unusual and surprising how biodiverse it is compared to pretty much the rest of the world. It's a really unusual area.
Well, Rocky Fork lies basically in a corridor that includes Great Smoky Mountains National Park. As a matter of fact, the Appalachian National Scenic Trail crosses part of the Rocky Fork track, as it does Great Smoky Mountains National Park, 50 miles southwest of Rocky Fork. That chain of mountains is sort of a protected corridor that Rocky Fork is part of, and therefore there's lots of the same species that you would find in the Smokies: black bear, native trout, grouse, turkey, deer, lots of other species, as well as some of the less known species, like small species like salamanders and lots of different kinds of birds and insects and so forth.
You know, so driving along Interstate 26, again between Asheville and Johnson City, Tennessee, it's really a wild stretch, and I don't recall seeing any houses there. I mean, are there any dwellings or any settlements or anything you could call even a village in Rocky Fork?
Not on the 10,000-acre track that we got preserved. In the lower elevations, in the valleys at the foot of the track, along the creek valleys, I call them, there are residential areas, and that's where the private land lies. But as a matter of fact, there's a small community called Rocky Fork adjacent to the track. That's where my family on my father's side goes back several generations.
You know, even living in northeast Tennessee, as I have for the past 8 years, I'm not entirely clear on what all the mountains around here are. Can you quickly differentiate for us between the Appalachians, and I mentioned the Blue Ridge Mountains, and the Great Smoky Mountains, which everyone's heard of, and the Unakas, which are less known, you know, nationally, and other major mountain ranges in this region of western North Carolina and eastern Tennessee? You know, how do they line up, and which ones are which?
The entire region that you mentioned, East Tennessee and Western North Carolina, that we're talking about today, is part of the Southern Appalachian region of the Greater Appalachian Range. That Southern Appalachian portion also sort of comprises the Southern Blue Ridge, which is a subregion of the Appalachians. And the Blue Ridge generally runs from central Virginia around Shenandoah National Park, roughly down to Great Smoky Mountains National Park, although some people refer to the Blue Ridge even in North Georgia. But to answer your question, in this region, we're talking about the Southern Appalachians in general, the Blue Ridge a little more specifically, and then you mentioned the Unakas. And the Unakas are a sub-range of the Blue Ridge and the Southern Appalachians that Rocky Fork is a part of.
Yeah, it's interesting. You tend to think of the Blue Ridge Mountains as being kind of the ones you can see from the Blue Ridge Parkway, but clearly from what you're saying, it's a lot bigger and more expansive than that.
It is, and there's been some confusions over the years about where the Blue Ridge is and is not. One thing that kind of clarifies that is whether you're talking about the Blue Ridge proper, which roughly does follow the Blue Ridge Parkway, or if you're talking about what geographers call the Blue Ridge Physiographic Province, or the Blue Ridge Province. And that covers a much wider area that includes the high mountain region of northeast Tennessee. And there are about five counties in northeast Tennessee which border western North Carolina. And those counties are mountainous counties and are definitely part of the western edge of the Blue Ridge Province. So East Tennessee, Northeast Tennessee has never really, I guess, acknowledged that it's a part of the Blue Ridge, but from a geographic standpoint, it definitely is.
Okay, well, that's interesting. So let's talk about the park itself, which, you know, we mentioned that Rocky Fork is about 10,000 acres, but Rocky Fork State Park is only a little over 2,000 acres, which is only about a fifth of the overall tract that was bought and set aside for conservation. Who controls the rest? I mean, the other 8,000 acres or so, how's it managed and for what purposes?
When Rocky Fork was first transferred to the federal government and the state of Tennessee, the 8,000 acres that you're talking about became part of the Cherokee National Forest, which is managed by the federal government. And the state of Tennessee had contributed roughly $6 million to the purchase of the 10,000-acre tract. So that $6 million helped the state acquire the roughly 2,000 acres that became Rocky Fork State Park. So it really was the state of Tennessee and the federal government through the U.S. Forest Service that made the purchase possible. Now it's all public land, the whole 10,000 acres, and protected as such.
Yeah, okay, so I didn't realize it's part of the Cherokee National Forest now, but it's great that the whole 10,000 acres is totally beyond reach of development forever now, so that's great. Let's talk about the whole, basically, decade-long process of gaining protection for this land. When did you first learn it was threatened with development, David? Walk us through the whole basic timeline of what happened after you first got fired up about it.
I first learned about the potential threat to Rocky Fork in the mid-1990s when a friend of mine by the name of Ed Williams III, who was an attorney and former judge here in northeast Tennessee, and he was an old friend of mine, and we ran into each other one day, and he mentioned to me that Rocky Fork, which I was obviously familiar with through my family connections, that the tract might be sold by the company that owned it and possibly turned into a big private gated development. And of course, I was alarmed at hearing that and pledged to Ed to do whatever I could to help keep that from happening. And Ed was actually leading the effort at that time to get Rocky Fork turned into publicly protected land. And he was sounding the alarm to various organizations and elected officials and so forth and letting them know that that was an area that really should be protected. And so in the beginning, in the mid-1990s, I was kind of working in the background to help spread the word for Ed. And over the next several years, that was my role until Ed passed away in 2004. We had another chance in 2005 to possibly get the land purchased and protected. But since Ed was gone, there was really nobody to lead the grassroots effort, kind of sound the rallying cry to bring people together to get it done. And so that's when I stepped in to try to lead the local effort.
Yeah, so there's always attention, you know, and we've all seen this and read about it across the country, between trying to get conservation protection for lands that are very attractive for development. And in this area, it happens that, you know, we mentioned the Cherokee National Forest, already about a third of Unicoi County, which is kind of a large part of where Rocky Fork is already in the National Forest, the Cherokee National Forest, and that brings in no taxes to the local government. Now it was proposed that more land be added to the forest and to a state park as well, maybe. And it really ran into a buzzsaw of kind of tension between the legitimate need to increase the tax base on the part of the local politicians and a good portion of the residents, right, and the wish to preserve what was basically an irreplaceable natural asset. So there's always that tension, and that's always, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road as far as the fights on these things. So tell us just briefly how that went on and, you know, without getting into the political details too much, what was that like?
That was really the crux of the issue. And being a native of the county where Rocky Fork is located, that issue wasn't lost on me by any means. And, you know, property taxes pay for your schools and your roads and your law enforcement and so forth. And it's not a wealthy county. It's a rural mountain county in northeast Tennessee. And so those property taxes are vitally important to a county like that. And so I definitely understood that part of the issue. And as a matter of fact, I never argued that those taxes and so forth were not important. My argument in the effort to save Rocky Fork is that there are some places that need to be preserved. They're so special and so important from a natural resource standpoint, conservation standpoint, that they deserve to be protected for future generations and really not considered as a place that could be developed for tax revenue, that they really needed to be set aside, and Rocky Fork was one of those places. And that's where the idea for a state park came from. In the early days of the campaign to save Rocky Fork, we were faced with that dilemma that you mentioned, and a lot of local people in the county, as you mentioned, really wanted Rocky Fork to stay pretty much as it always had been and open to the public for fishing and hiking and hunting and mountain biking and so forth. But they were torn because they realized how important it would be if the area were developed and the county received the additional tax revenue from that development. And so that's really where the idea was born of turning at least part of the tract into a state park if we could get it protected. And we started promoting that idea locally, and a lot of people thought that that would be a good way, good compromise, a good win-win situation, because a state park would draw visitors who would spend money, and there would possibly be new businesses that would open up and new development in more appropriate areas of the county where there was already some infrastructure and that were less fragile, less environmentally sensitive. People really liked that idea. That's how we won a lot more local support for the conservation effort.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with David Ramsey, who was one of the leading lights in the effort to establish Rocky Fork State Park in Tennessee and also to set aside a larger area around it, encompassing altogether about 10,000 acres for public lands and kind of take it out of the path of development. Ultimately a successful effort, which is not always the case, right? So that's why we're talking with David. Whose idea was it, David, to actually try for the state park initially?
Well, I believe that it was mine. There may have been others that were thinking about something like that around the same time, but I hadn't really heard anybody speak up about that prospect. When we were kind of in the heat of the battle regarding the tax base versus the conservation issue, I did a lot of thinking around that time about how we could overcome that obstacle and how we could gain more local support for protecting priceless treasure. And so the state park or some kind of a state or federally designated park idea came to me, and I proposed that to then county mayor Greg Lynch. Greg thought that that was a very good idea. And I also mentioned it to some of the lead organizations that were working on the Rocky Fork campaign. Turns out they actually had thought of that as a possibility. And so they developed a consensus that promoting that idea of a state park could build more public support, might build more support from the decision makers and elected officials. And so that was the direction that we decided to go in at that time. And that was it was probably around 2007 or so.
So you and others got a lot of pretty much heavy hitters involved as far as national environmental organizations and local and state and national groups of outdoorsmen and women and some, you know, high-level state politicians. I mean, it took a lot of players who had different areas of expertise to come at it and different levels of power to exert on getting this done. So just briefly, kind of who were... You mentioned a couple of people, but who are some of the main players, especially environmentally and politically, and what did they do, just kind of briefly?
Well, there were three main lead organizations, conservation organizations, that actually were involved in negotiations with the original owner of the Rocky Fork Tract, which was a land timber investment company out of Atlanta, Georgia. And those three organizations really did the heavy lifting of trying to find the funding and negotiating with the owners. And those were the Conservation Fund, which I guess you'd have to say was the lead organization in the campaign. The Appalachian Trail Conservancy, which had a lot to gain from protecting Rocky Fork because the Appalachian Trail crossed part of the track. And main missions is to protect the viewshed of the Appalachian Trail all the way from Georgia to Maine. And so they were heavily involved. And then regionally, the Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy. And I can't say enough about that group, because that was the first organization that I called when I learned about the threat to Rocky Fort. They actually got the ball rolling on a regional level and brought in some of the national groups, and were able to find funding from some private philanthropists, and were just extremely instrumental in moving the campaign forward. And so those were the three lead groups. And then there were so many other organizations, sportsmen's groups, such as National Wild Turkey Federation, Trout Unlimited, the Rough Grouse Society, so forth. And then local groups, mountain bike clubs, hiking clubs, local conservation groups, and so forth. And many, many individuals who understood the importance of Rocky Fork, key individuals were involved. A couple of other elected officials from the area where Rocky Fork is located, who were instrumental in saving the area, were U.S. Congressman David Davis and the town of Unicoi Mayor Johnny Lynch, and biologists and private citizens and business people and so forth. So it was a pretty large collection of people who collaborated to make it happen.
Yeah, and a lot of those organizations probably made strange bedfellows, maybe people that and groups that were normally on opposite sides of an issue, but here a very disparate group of people came together for the same common purpose. And I imagine there was, over the long period of time it took, people in organizations typically do come and go in a long-running effort like that, but I think you named probably the ones who were the central anchors that kept it all moving forward. Was there anybody else? I imagine you were certainly one of them, but any other particular key individuals or players who stayed through the whole thing and kept being the glue that was holding it together?
Well, the three main organizations that I mentioned, certainly, they were there from the very beginning, back in the mid-90s when Ed Williams was leading the effort. I have to give him credit for kind of laying the foundation of the campaign by pulling some of those organizations together. And, of course, the U.S. Forest Service, at the time that Rocky Fork was purchased for public protection, it was the number one land acquisition priority for the U.S. Forest Service in the entire United States. And they had always wanted to acquire that land to fill in an important section of the Cherokee National Forest that lay in the region surrounding Rocky Fork. And so Rocky Fork really filled in parts of the National Forest that already existed in that general area. And so the Forest Service was always a key player, and they deserve a lot of credit for it. From an individual standpoint, can't say enough about U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander, who was really the champion from the standpoint of elected leaders of Rocky Fork, who was able to obtain roughly $30 million of the $40 million that it took to purchase the tract.
Yeah, in fact, the park was recently named Lamar Alexander Rocky Fork State Park, you know, in recognition of his important contribution, because when it comes time to raise tens of millions of dollars, local people, typically, that's beyond their reach, and you need some big guns to do that. So, you know, what's funny is that the threat of the land being bought by a private developer, as I read it, appeared around 2005. And that was right before the Great Recession began in 2006 or 7 or so.
Right.
So did the timing of the collapse of the economic and housing bubble, and this would have been high-end housing that would have been slated for development there, did that play into your efforts in a positive way?
It might have. If it did, it's not something that I personally was aware of or that I heard discussed a lot at the time. I just know that that in the late 1990s, there was an effort that Ed Williams led to get the land purchased, and a tentative deal was struck to purchase the land for roughly $7 million. And at the last minute, that deal fell through because somebody came along and offered $16 million for it. Mm-hmm. And of course, they won the contest, and that was in 1999. And then a couple of years later, during the recession of the early 2000s, 2001 and 2002, the owners of Rocky Fork started talking about selling it. And, of course, Ed was on top of things, and he was able to pull everybody together for another tentative agreement to purchase the land for public use and protection for $18.5 million. At the last minute, that deal also fell through because we started coming out of that recession, and the company that owned Rocky Fork thought that their shareholders and their board members thought that maybe they should hold on to it a little bit longer since the recession was ending, and that they might be able to profit a little bit more later on. And sure enough, it was only 6 years later that that $18.5 million became $40 million, which is what they received for the land in 2008.
Yeah, so that's a steep rise during a recession, and it shows that the people who owned the property knew they had some very committed and impassioned potential buyers.
Motivated buyers.
Motivated,
absolutely.
There you go.
And I have to add to that, Court, that I never, ever heard anybody that any of the leaders, especially the three main organizations who were trying to find the funding and put the deal together that I mentioned earlier, I never heard any of them, at least publicly, or even to me privately, say that it was just too much money for that land, because it came down to about $4,000 an acre of totally undeveloped mountain, rugged, rural mountain land.
Yeah.
And $4,000 an acre, especially at that time, was a whole lot of money. But I never heard any of them say that they thought it was too much, because all of us felt like, in the end, that it was a real bargain, because that's how special that watershed actually was and how important it was to protect it.
Well, that actually occurred to me, too, because $4,000 an acre for land you couldn't get to was, in a recession, was pretty steep, especially for a tract that big. And I wondered whether appraisers considered that a fair price. And I think you just answered that basically the people who are contributing to the purchase of it thought that it was a good deal at any price. But I do wonder whether there was some sense that in the middle or toward the end of a recession, for the price to go that high was price gouging because some deep government and environmental group pockets were involved. And I suspect there was that, and I'm surprised there wasn't pushback on that, but I'm glad there wasn't in the end. But it is kind of funny when you think about it.
Yeah, I see exactly what you're talking about. But again, I believe that everyone felt that this was, I guess a good way to put it is, the late Ed Williams always referred to Rocky Fork as the last crown jewel of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And it had all of the features of the most beautiful, most scenic, and most ecologically important regions of the Blue Ridge. And so it was kind of a missing piece of the Blue Ridge puzzle, so to speak, and really needed to be protected. And we knew that that would be the absolute last chance to get it protected, and that conservation dollars very rarely can compete with development dollars. And so in a few years, it would cost even more than that. And so it was really kind of a last-ditch effort. You can say that from the standpoint of land deals, conservation side was kind of up against the wall. But again, I never, ever heard them say that they didn't think it was worth it. And in my opinion, you can't really put a price on a place like that.
Well, the purchase of Rocky Fork closed on December 15th, 2008. And to you personally and to everybody else involved, but especially to you personally, that must have felt like an impossible dream coming true, did it? I mean, did you feel like you had to pinch yourself?
It was a surreal day. I can remember getting the phone call that the deal had, the closing had taken place, and the deal was completed. I was almost numb. I was almost speechless, because it really did feel like sort of an impossible dream. I can remember a few years earlier when we first really started working hard for protection of Rocky Fork. I remember getting a phone call from Mayor Lynch one day that ran into a local person from Unicoi County who sort of mocked our effort and said that we didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of getting that land protected up there. And even ask Mayor Lynch, what does that Ramsey guy think he's going to do, write a check, a $40 million check? And so there were a lot of people that never gave us a chance, but we just never stopped working in that effort and never stopped giving up hope that we could pull it together. And again, a lot of credit goes to those three lead organizations and Senator Lamar Alexander, who really made it happen.
Well, good for you for pulling off the impossible. What do they say? The difficult I'll do right now, but the impossible will take about 12 or 14 years. Yeah. And that's what it seemed to take. I tell you, so we don't have much time left, David, just a couple minutes, but so this is a big question to ask you in a limited amount of time, but there are many areas around the country that, like this, are unique and mostly unspoiled ecosystems, but that are threatened with development, either residential or commercial. And like we said before, there's always tension between jobs and tax revenues and conservation. So, if you can say in a nutshell, what are some lessons drawn from your experience with Rocky Fork that can be applied elsewhere?
For one thing, I guess I could definitely say that there is tremendous power in numbers. A lot of individuals and organizations and members of recreational groups, conservation groups, sporting groups, what have you, all had some connection to that land up there. And so they came together and collaborated over common ground, so to speak. And so when you have a lot of people that care about something that come together and really don't care who gets the credit, big things can happen. And then number two, I'd have to say if there's a region that is threatened and it's a really special natural area, the first thing that you have to do is look at the big picture. And the big picture always has to do with economics. If there is a way to protect it, benefit the local economy or economies of local communities that are surrounding that region and that area, then that's what you need to focus on, because that's really really one of the things that helped us get Rocky Fork protected. Is when we started talking about the state park idea, people immediately saw the economic benefits of that. And so that would be the main lesson, I guess, that I draw from it.
Okay, well, those are good points. Well, I want to say that David Ramsey was named the 2011 National Hero of Conservation by Field & Stream magazine and the Toyota Motor Company. He has since received other major national conservation awards for his work on Rocky Fork. So, just quickly, David, what are the amenities for visitors at the park now? I don't think there's much in there yet, but what is planned?
I have to say that from the time we started talking about developing a state park there, we always talked about keeping it relatively primitive because it was such a fragile area. So right now you have signed hiking trails, you have a nice parking area, and coming in the near future there will be an interpretive visitor center, a small, relatively primitive campground, a few backcountry campsites, and some picnic facilities and restroom facilities. And all of those will take place on less than 50 acres of the 2,000-plus acre state park.
Well, that'll be great. And again, it's south of Irwin, Tennessee, and north and over the mountains from Asheville, North Carolina, just off of I-26. Now, David's book, again, is Rocky Fork, Hidden Jewel of the Blue Ridge Wild. And the author, again, David Ramsey, R-A-M-S-E-Y, can be ordered through his website, ramseyphotos.com. And if you go there, you can also see some very beautiful photos of the area there. I mentioned that that David's a professional landscape photographer, and so there's some really pretty stuff on the website, ramseyphotos.com. Well, David, thank you so much for being on, and congratulations again for, on behalf of you and all of your colleagues, in getting this huge project over the hump and done a few years ago, and it's really quite an achievement.
Well, thank you for having me, Cord. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.